Asking the right questions can greatly impact your future, especially when it comes to your finances. So if you're looking for a financial advisor you can trust, certified financial planner professionals are committed to acting in your best interest. That's why it's got to be a CFP. Find your CFP professional at letsmakeaplan.org.
Hey, everybody, I want to talk to you for a second here about Canva, specifically Canva presentations that are designed for every workplace and every department. Whether you work in sales, marketing, HR, ops, and more, Canva presentations can generate any deck you want for work. Sales decks, marketing presentations, onboarding plans, you name it. Any department can save time on any presentation. So start designing today at canva.com. Design for work. Just go to Canva, C-A-N-V-A.com.
Welcome to Stuff You Should Know from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, and welcome to the podcast. I'm Josh Clark. There's Charles W. Chuck Bryant.
How you doing?
Hey, and Jerry's over there. Jerry, for the first time, just saw a meme that's been out for a couple of years.
Yeah, that happened. That's like when you Rickrolled me like 2 years after it was popular.
Right.
You're like, isn't that the best?
Well, I was lying in wait.
Yeah, I bet that happens though. And there's nothing more obnoxious than sending someone something and be like, I saw that 2 years ago.
Yeah, it's like,
well, I'm so sorry. I tried to show you something funny.
Right, right.
You know? But yeah, Jerry just saw the, do we even say?
The mumble-mouthed reporter, maybe?
Yeah.
The lady who supposedly had a migraine but appeared to have had a stroke,
right,
reporting from the Grammys in Los Angeles a couple of years ago.
Yeah, I still don't know whether it's okay to laugh at that because I don't know really what happened to her.
Well, we didn't laugh. We very solemnly showed Jerry.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And she laughed.
Terrible, Jerry.
Terror station.
I've got one for you.
Okay.
I've got a bit of an intro. It's not much, so
great.
Don't get your hopes up.
All right.
Have you ever heard of the Population Reference Bureau?
No.
You have, because I've mentioned it before.
Ugh.
I've mentioned this article before. It's on PRB.org. It's called How Many People Have Ever Lived on Earth?
Okay.
And I don't know what we mentioned it in, maybe the population episode.
Sure.
Or something. But it's a really cool little article by this demographer named Carl Haub, H-A-U-B. And he, there's even a video of him explaining it if you couldn't get what he was going with. But Haub, he reckons that modern humans, people who are virtually indistinguishable from you or me, aside from the fact that they're not wearing like any clothes really.
Sure.
Showed up about 52,000 years ago.
Okay.
So Haub puts the population of humanity at 2 in 50,000 BCE.
Oh.
Okay.
Yeah.
So from that point to 2011,
mm-hmm,
he extrapolates, does the math. This is a little demography thing.
Yeah.
And Haub comes up with the number that 107,602,707,791 people have ever lived between 50,000 BC and 2011 CE.
That's pretty neat.
It is. That's a lot of people. He says that means about 6.5% of that are alive right now. Or were in 2011.
All right, so we're dying off?
Yeah, that's the point. All 107,602,707,791 of those people had one thing in common. One thing, aside from being humans.
Taxes.
No, not even. Not even.
Pre-tax.
Men. Yeah, they didn't have tax in 50,000 BC. They had running from saber-toothed tigers.
And death.
Death. It was death. That's the one thing all 107,602,707,791 of those people had in common.
You know, when I was thinking of your intro driving here today, I thought that'd be funny if Josh was like, how long people been dying, Chuck? And you know what? This wasn't that far off.
Nice.
I was like, he wouldn't do that.
you're like, that'd be way too boring. What but, a stupid way to
no,
intro
No, that's a good
this.
Number. I like that. 107,602,000
Mm-hmm.
7,791.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, and that includes you and me, pal. You know what that means? You're going to die.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to die.
Yeah.
Jerry's going to die at least two or three times. We're all going to die.
Yeah, this is our dying podcast.
And we have covered just about every aspect of dying. Can you die from a broken heart? How rigor mortis works? What's the worst way to die?
Yeah. Is there a best way to die? Did we do that?
That was kind of in the, is there a worse way to die? Yeah. We've covered everything from autopsies.
Peak oil.
What can be done with a dead body.
Ninjas.
Yeah. Well, ninja, at least. You should know better than that.
Yeah, we really have danced around everything except just how dying works. And this is going to be a sad podcast in many ways. And gruesome in some ways.
Yeah.
Because we're going to touch on some of the stuff we hit on in like rigor mortis and autopsies and the actual dying process.
Right. But, I mean.
So brace yourselves.
And I've mentioned this guy scores of times at least. But as the
Thomas
great.
Mann?
No.
No.
It's Charles Mann you're thinking of.
Oh, okay.
The great psychologist, Ernest Becker.
Oh, yeah.
Shout out to our pal Joe Randazzo.
Yeah.
Who's like into Becker now.
Isn't it Ernst or is it Ernest?
Ernest.
Okay.
You're thinking of Max Ernst.
Okay.
Ernest Becker wrote The Denial of Death.
Right.
Seminal work that basically says we're all just doing everything we can to think about our own demise.
Yeah.
And there is some sort of health, whether it's spiritual, emotional, there's some sort of health or well-being, I think, from facing the fact that you're going to die.
Sure.
And talking about it.
Yeah.
So let's talk about death, baby. Let's talk about you and me.
Let's do it.
Okay.
So Molly Edmonds, who used to be on Sminty, Stuff Mom Never Told You, we call it Sminty.
Sure.
Wrote this one, and I think it is interesting, and I usually don't like it when articles say, like, the definition of blah, 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 but it's kind of interesting that in the first encyclopedia, it was just the separation of the soul from the body, and now it's, you know, 30 times that long in the encyclopedia.
Right.
And that's just sort of indicative of how we used to think of it and how, I don't know if it's ironic or not, but how medical science has complicated that over the years.
Yeah, well, it's definitely ironic because, I mean, we used to be confident that we understood death. It's like, that person isn't moving anymore. If you ask him what he wants to eat, he's not going to respond. If you choose something for him to eat, like a block of cheese, it's not going to be swallowed. Like,
yeah.
That's death. And since there was perhaps a lot more religiousness associated with death and dying than there is today.
Yeah.
That kind of underscored the belief in death. It's the soul departing from the body.
That's right.
And what more do you want to know, egghead? It's death.
Well, yeah. And, way back, you know, a few hundred years ago, you'd call in a priest and they'd check the body, see if it's breathing and say, yep, they're dead. And that was pretty much it. The doctor wasn't even involved at that point.
Well, there may not have even been such a thing as doctors. And if there were, they were wearing like masks that made them look like crows to protect them from the plague. So they weren't any better at ascertaining death than a priest was.
That's true. When doctors did come along and they invented things like the stethoscope, they could actually check and see if there was a heartbeat. Before that, there was Balfour's test,
mm-hmm.
which I couldn't find out a lot about this other than you stick needles into the heart with little flags on it and see if the flags move.
I think that's pretty straightforward.
Really?
Yeah, I think that's about it. I mean,
okay.
That's the test.
I'll buy that.
And there were other tests that, like, a priest who may have come to say whether you were dead or not would use, like, placing a feather above the mouth or around the mouth or nose to see if it moves.
The old mirror check.
Mirror trick.
Yeah, that's still, you know, useful.
It is, but only if the mouth is still moist. If it's a dried mouth, it's probably not going to fog up a mirror.
Well, if it's not breathing, it's not going to fog up a mirror.
Right, exactly.
So I said that medical science has complicated it, and that's exactly what's happened over the years because as we progressed with medicine, we discovered a lot of ways to actually reverse death, like bring people back from the dead. Whether it's something as easy as CPR
mm-hmm.
or as complicated as, you know, machines that help you breathe and feed you.
Right. And not only that, we've entered this really awkward period in human medical history where the machines that can tell us whether someone is alive or not are more advanced than our machines that can bring a person back from death.
Yeah.
So we have ways to sustain the body.
Yeah, yeah, I see what you mean.
But not necessarily the person, depending on your definition of death.
Yeah, like the faintest trace of a brain wave, maybe.
Right, yeah. So we went from holding a feather under somebody's mouth or nose to see if they're alive to using the MRIs to see whether there's electrical activity. And we're finding that all of these old signs, these old outward signs of death, don't necessarily mean that the person's dead. And even if the person is dead, we have technology, like you were saying, to resuscitate them. The question is, if we resuscitate them and they're still not talking, they still don't tell you what they want to eat.
Yeah.
Are they alive?
Well, yeah. And this hasn't been that long, you know. I mean, in the 52,000 years or whatever that people have been dying, it's only been the past, you know, 60-something that we've had to come up with terms like persistent vegetative state and irreversible coma.
Yeah. Because of those machines that can resuscitate or sustain a body.
And in 1958, that was when a French neurologist described the coma de passe, which is a state beyond coma, basically brain death, although that didn't come along until 1968 when Harvard Medical School did basically defined it for the first time.
Yeah.
Although they didn't even call it brain death at the time.
What'd they call it?
Just irreversible coma, like you're not coming back.
Gotcha.
Brain death was kind of tagged on later.
So coma de passe, persistent vegetative state, brain death. All of these things would indicate, again, that you're dead. The problem is we have these machines that can keep your body warm,
yeah,
and keep your chest rising and falling, can keep your body going indefinitely.
Yeah.
But the thing is there's something that's not there. And does that mean you're dead? There's been a lot of talk about exactly what constitutes death. Defining death is a very, very difficult thing to do, especially through the advancement of medical technology. It's kind of changed. Every time you come up with I got it. This is the definition of death.
Right.
Medical technology can provide some picture of a state of consciousness or life that throws a wrench in the works, you know?
Yeah, and it's actually after 1968, it took till 1981, a presidential commission is when they finally in the United States wrote a paper called Defining Death, Medical, Legal, and Ethical Issues in the Determination of Death. That was the basis for the Uniform Determination of Death Act, which basically rejected the Harvard idea that of the higher brain, which is like when your personality and your memories are gone, the cortical brain, that means you're dead. And they rejected that in favor of the whole brain, which includes the brain stem, which is what keeps you breathing and functioning. They rejected it in favor of that. So Harvard was like, meh.
Right. I don't know. I think I subscribe to the higher brain death, the definition of death.
Yeah.
The brain stem, it's pretty significant.
Sure.
You can be born with just a brain stem. We've talked about Mike the Headless Chicken before.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
He had his head cut off, which included his brain, but his brain stem was still there, and he's a chicken, so it didn't really matter.
Sure.
There's a huge division between the two, because there's a big difference between breathing and being able to swallow for yourself.
Yeah.
And making a conscious decision whether, again, what you want to eat right then.
Yeah, or having memories or just reacting to people aside from, like, you know, physical reaction.
Right, exactly.
To a stimulus.
Yes, and that's there's a whole article on brain death. Maybe we'll do that one.
I thought we did that, no?
I think we did it in the organ donation procurement episode. We talked about brain death and testing for brain death. Like, they shoot ice cold water in your ear canal.
I definitely remember covering it at some point, somehow.
Yeah, I think it was in the organ donation one.
Or maybe living wills, obviously. We might have touched on it then.
Did we do that one? We did wills.
We did wills, but we hit on living wills in that. But, you know, you mentioned organs. I don't think we said that that was a big kind of a quandary in the 1960s. Mid-1950s and then really in the 1960s is when we went organ transplant crazy, actually kind of not just the United States, all over the world. Doctors said, hey, we can actually give people a shot at life because we can now transplant kidneys and lungs and hearts. The problem was, and this is sort of one of the sad things that Molly points out, is that the definition of death kind of came about, was hurried along maybe because we needed organs from these bodies that were still technically alive.
Which is a very ghoulish proposition. I mean, it makes sense from a very utilitarian standpoint. It's like, this guy doesn't even know he's laying there.
Yeah, and he's got a great kidney that could go to his sister.
who knows that she needs a kidney or she's going to die, and she's got kids that she wants to hang out with and, like, can put this kidney to good use. So let's figure this out. But as Molly says, like, most developed countries have signed on to the brainstem, where it's like your brain can no longer keep you alive, like, on your own. You can't swallow. You can't take a breath for yourself. So you're dead. The problem is that's different. That's a much more, it's a narrower definition of death, I guess.
Right.
And I think that probably rules out a lot of people who might otherwise be used to harvest organs.
Yeah. Harvest.
I know.
All right. So let's talk about death itself. It's funny that it's not funny, but out of all the different ways people can die, I thought it seemed simplified to break it down into three ways, but that's really kind of the three ways.
Yeah, I think we talked about that in autopsies too, right?
Yeah, it can be an accident, obviously.
That's called the oopsie mode of death.
Yeah, the violent death, which is also an oopsie, I guess. Well, not an oopsie.
No.
It's tragic.
Yeah.
Homicide or suicide.
So, Chuck, let's talk about what it's like to die from different types of death. You dug this up, you ghoul.
Yeah, because I really wanted to know, like, what is it like to drown or to be burned alive?
Yeah, and people have survived
some
of these things and come back to tell the tale.
That's obviously the only way we're going to find this stuff out
are
from lucky people. Drowning, I've always heard drowning is a good way to go because it's not so painful.
Yeah, and the brain supposedly releases endorphins at the end.
Yeah.
Same with freezing, I've heard, too.
Maybe true. Although drowning victims have reported, aside from the panic, a tearing and burning sensation when your water starts filling with lungs.
Yeah.
And quickly, hopefully, really quickly after that is the feeling of calmness.
Yes.
That overcomes
and tranquility.
Yeah.
A heart attack, you've got the squeezing chest pain in your chest or your left arm.
Yeah, or like a weight on your chest.
Right. What I didn't know is that because of the heart not delivering oxygen to the brain any longer, you can lose consciousness within like 10 seconds.
Uh-huh.
I didn't realize that. I thought like it was, there was a lot more to it.
Well, it depends, you know. Everyone has their own signature heart attack as well.
Sure.
If you bleed out, I imagine this is not one of the best ways to go. After about a liter and a half of blood, you're going to be thirsty and weak and anxious.
Mm-hmm.
Anything over two, you're going to be pretty confused and dizzy and probably lose consciousness pretty soon after.
And all of that would relate to how fast you're losing blood.
Sure.
And it would probably be very unpleasant depending on how you're losing blood, like why, because you would imagine that if you're stabbed in the gut or something like that, you got the attendant pain in addition to this dying from loss of blood.
Yeah, or like, man, Reservoir Dogs.
Yeah.
That was like one of the most hardcore ways to open a movie.
Yeah.
Or not open, but they cut right to that scene after the diner scene.
Right, after the walk.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Electrocution. If you're in your house and you get electrocuted, it could stop your heart right then and there. And if you're in an electric chair, you may have actually heated your brain up to the point where you die or suffocated to death.
Right, but there's indications that being electrocuted with enough voltage
knocks you out.
That it instantly... you lose consciousness.
Right. That's the idea, probably.
Yeah.
With the quote-unquote humane. I'm sorry, quote, humane, end quote. I'm going to stop doing that. I'm going back to quote-unquote.
Yeah.
What if you fall from a height?
If you fall from a height, supposedly time slows, which is awful.
Yeah.
It's like, well, you're going to experience all of this.
Yeah.
That's, the idea that you really can take it all in.
That's really awful.
So they did a study of jumpers from the Golden Gate Bridge, which is 75 meters. What is that? 230, 40 feet.
It's high enough. That's how high it is.
And they found evidence that a lot of them died from exploded lungs, exploded hearts. Their organs were all cut up from their ribs.
Yeah,
which would indicate death was pretty much instantaneous.
Yeah, we talked about that on something too recently, I think. Or maybe I heard someone else talking about it. That's a pretty bad way to go.
What, the Golden Gate Bridge? Or
just
falling, dying from a height?
Yeah, I can't remember who I was talking to about jumping in the water. I was like, what actually kills you when you jump in the water from that high? And it was like your organs smash into each other and explode.
Yeah, I guess from any height.
Yeah.
When you die from that, it'd be from organ explosion or whatever.
Yeah, or, you know, the brain, obviously.
Yeah.
If you go head first.
Hanging?
Yeah, that's the long drop back in the day would... Although they still, you can get hung in certain states if you choose.
Really?
Yeah, Washington State, I know you can.
Huh.
You can choose that as your method, and they'll build you the gallows. And the idea there is you want your neck to snap. Otherwise,
yes,
you die slower and, you know, suffocate.
The problem is there is a study of 34 prisoners that found 4/5 of them died partly from asphyxiation.
Really?
That's the wrong way to hang somebody.
It's, yeah.
If you don't snap their neck or they don't lose consciousness immediately, they sit there and hang and die of asphyxiation. That's a bad way to go.
Wow. And speaking of bad, I think being burned to death may be one of the worst.
Isn't that what we came up with on the
worst way to die? I think so, because you feel it and you'd think like your nerve endings, that's what I thought, like, oh, your nerve endings are probably like, stop responding quickly, but apparently that's not the case.
No, not only is that not the case, apparently the fire further sensitizes your nerve ending, so you feel even more pain.
Wow.
Yeah, but luckily, most people, I think the vast majority of people who die in fires actually die from smoke inhalation before they ever feel pain from fire.
Yeah, I don't know about before they feel pain, but hopefully quick enough.
Well, you know, carbon monoxide sinks, so like, well, there's a lot of smoke, you are down low to the ground, and that's where the carbon monoxide is, so you're inhaling mostly that. So it's possible it's before.
That's true. And then the natural death, which is passing of old age or disease, and here in this country, we have kind of whipped up a lot of the disease over the years into they've sniffed them off the case.
Right. Well, it depends. Like some of the ones that like kill undeveloped countries, like diarrheal diseases, like dying from diarrhea.
Yeah.
You don't have that much in the U.S., but we have chronic disease like obesity and diabetes and cardiopulmonary disease.
Yeah.
We have that down pat.
I've got the top five here, actually.
I think they're all in there, aren't they?
Heart is number one. Cancer is number two. Lower respiratory is number three, stroke is four, and accidents are five.
Yeah.
And it's a huge drop. Cancer and heart are close to 600,000. And then number three, lower respiratory is only 138,000. So that shows you what cancer and heart disease are doing
right,
in the United States, at least.
And the upshot of all this is that most of us are not going to die suddenly, either by accident or by violent death.
Yeah, dying of old age didn't used to be a thing.
No, it was like
it was like a lot of ways to die, but that wasn't one of them.
You ticked off some traveling knight, or there was a dispute over grazing rights,
or the plague.
Yeah, you walked into a bear cave.
Yeah,
yeah, the plague's another one. But yeah, old age is it's kind of a new thing, but it's one of the most prevalent forms of death. In developed countries, it actually has its own name, frailty.
Yeah, which is great. It's sad, but it's great that now we can live out our lives, and we're about to talk about it, but sometimes the body, just like any other machine, just stops working.
Right. It's not designed to keep going indefinitely, and
no.
Ultimately the system shuts down as its subsystems shut down.
Dude, it's shutting down every second.
Right.
Right now,
that's
our bodies
exactly
are shutting
right.
down very slowly.
And for that reason, because you and I are both dying, I guess once you're born, you start dying.
Yeah.
Or after you stop growing, you start dying, right?
Is that just the positive outlook? Or?
But I mean, like, you're shedding cells, and like, uh-huh. This is like the dying, we're in the midst of the dying process. Just this natural system is in the winding down, although it takes decades and we still have plenty to do.
Yeah.
Like you said, you're dying, I'm dying.
Yeah.
That's why they have a more specific definition of death, which is called active dying. Like, you and I are not actively dying right now.
No.
No. Instead, if we are actively dying, we're in the midst of the dying process.
Yeah, it has started. The dying process has started. The descent, if you will, has started.
Right. So all this kind of happens since different types of cells die at different speeds.
That's what it is. It's cell death.
Right. Cellular
death. I don't want to let the cat out of the bag, but oxygen doesn't happen to different parts of the body. Mm-hmm. Your cells are going to die.
Exactly. And so as the cells die at different speeds, different systems are going to shut down. But just from watching frail people die of old age, they kind of have like this, the order in which it happens kind of down pat.
Yeah.
So there's the pre-active dying phase, which can take about 3 weeks, starts about 3 weeks before death, 2 or 3 weeks.
Yeah.
And then there's the active dying phase, which can take a few days. And obviously that's not set in stone. None of this is set in stone, but this is all just, kind of cumulative knowledge from observations of people dying in like hospice and things like that. So you get the pre-active phase of dying. And like I said, it starts a couple weeks ahead of the actual death.
Yeah.
Because we have, this is a big deal right now, what we're talking about. Like, it's becoming very clear, in our modern age, that death is not an instant. It's not a moment. There's a process.
Yeah, well, unless it isn't an instant. But, yeah, old age dying.
Yes.
Or like other kinds of dying, but how about non-accidental dying?
Okay. We'll call it that.
Because that's like the instantaneous thing.
Right.
And even sometimes in a very short scale, that can follow some of these, you know?
Oh, yeah, I forgot it's audio. Yes. I was nodding my head.
Hey, everybody. It's halftime and the scoreboard is not looking good. You're feeling low and not sure you can pull out a win. And that's when you have to dig deep, lift your head up, and say to yourself, time to get back in the game. Pull off some bank heists and take as much of your friend's money as you possibly can.
That's right. The smash hit mobile game Monopoly Go lets you compete with your friends to get the most riches and the biggest empire. It's the Monopoly you love, but on your phone, anytime, with tons of new twists, including leaderboards to compare your progress to your buddies.
That's right. You can play on countless dynamic Monopoly boards. You can make your friends bankrupt by smashing their landmarks with a wrecking ball, and you can charge other players rent for your iconic properties.
Plus, you can even work with your friends to crack open community chests in tournaments to get rewards and climb the leaderboard.
So get back out there, put on your game face, and download Monopoly Go, now free on the App Store or Google Play.
Hey, everybody. If you're building a deck at work and you want to supercharge it, check out Canva presentations. Work docs have been the same for too long, but Canva docs are different. They're visual. They grab readers' attention with images, charts, tables, and videos playable right in the doc. Plus, docs don't have to be just words on a page. You can make your docs pop with Canva docs.
That's right. And Canva presentations are designed for every workplace and every department. Whether you work in sales, HR, ops, marketing, and more, Canva presentations can be the solution for you. Sales decks, marketing presentations, onboarding plans, you name it.
Canva presentations might be the most visually impressive presentations you'll ever use. You start with a stunning template, use it as a springboard for your design, adding images, graphics, charts, data visualizations, all from a massive media library. It's super easy to wow any audience with Canva presentations.
So start designing today at canva.com, designed for work. That's canva.com.
So the pre-active phase of dying, Chuck, what do we got?
Well, you're going to start sleep. You're going to get sleepy. You're not going to have much energy. You're going to start sleeping more and more. Your skin might become cooler to the touch, might turn a little bluish gray.
Yeah. Cyanosis. That's what that's called.
Oh, is that what that's called?
It's just becoming oxygen deprived. Like apparently your body's like, okay, don't really need to use the legs anymore because we're bedridden. So I'm going to start focusing more of the circulation on the, inner organs.
Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Well, that probably causes the mottling too, which is your skin can become sort of reddish, like splotchy, mm-hmm. with reddish blue splotches as well.
Right. You're gonna be a little restless, probably.
Yeah.
You're gonna possibly come off as confused.
You're not gonna be hungry.
No, you're gonna probably withdraw from social activities.
Yeah.
You're gonna become a little withdrawn. You might want to settle unfinished business with family. You might request family come visit you for that kind of thing.
Oh, sure. The non-physical parts, that's definitely something you'd be interested in doing.
Right. Yeah. But that's like apparently something that people intuitively know. Like they need to – apparently patients know – when they're dying.
I've seen that happen.
And one of the signs from that's mentioned in hospice care, palliative care,
yeah,
is that the patient may even state, I'm dying.
Yeah.
Like, I started. It's coming.
That's pretty common.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's sad that when you realize, like, all right, this is it. Like, I feel myself. I'm going to be gone soon.
But that's neat, though, especially if you
have that time, yeah.
Yeah, if you're like, okay, I'm going to put everything in order.
Sure.
And die happy or peacefully.
Yeah.
That's neat that you have that time to take care of that.
If you're fortunate enough to go that way, for sure.
Back to physically, you won't be able to heal from a wound or an infection any longer.
Yeah, you might lose control of your bladder and your bowels. Mm-hmm. Over the course of some time, you might be in pain, but chances are, here in the modern world, they're going to take care of you in that respect.
Right. And again, that's called palliative care, where at some point it's very obvious that you're going to die. And a lot of it can be based on what you want.
Sure.
But even without your wishes, there is probably a point in time where medical science says there's nothing we can do for you.
Yeah. We just want to make you comfortable.
Exactly. So we're going to give you pain meds. We're going to your care is being transferred over from a physician to who's, you know, wants to save your life and keep you going to hospice workers.
Yeah.
Healthcare professionals who are trained to just keep you as comfortable as possible for the duration of your life. Right.
And man, hats off to those people.
Yes.
Like all healthcare professionals, of course, but man, hospice nurses, that is tough stuff. You got to be made of the right qualities as a human,
sure,
to be able to tackle something like that and still get up and go to work every day.
Like, they're literally in the business of dying.
Yeah, I mean, very valuable service people provide.
So that's the pre-active phase. That's the I'm getting ready to die. I got a couple weeks, and all of my systems are starting to wind down.
Yeah.
In the active phase, the systems are starting to shut down. You may not have consciousness, and if you do, you may, if you are able to be aroused from unconsciousness, you're going to slip right back into it again, possibly. You are probably, and apparently families find this very disconcerting, you're probably going to talk about people who are dead as if they're in the room or you can see them or hear them.
Yeah, is this just the mind slipping?
They don't know. Hospice workers, from what I can tell, tend to just treat it like it's real, treat it on its own terms.
Yeah.
They're not saying it's real or it's a hallucination or something like that, and they advise families not to treat it like a hallucination, just to...
Not to correct them. Yeah, that makes sense, because you're there to provide comfort, not say, no, Grandpa, Grandma's been gone for years.
Exactly.
Why would you want to do that?
There is an exception to that. You would want to do that if they're fearful from their visions.
Oh, okay.
Then you can say, it's not real, it's just your brain, that's not real, or whatever.
Yeah, again, all about comfort.
Yes.
Yeah.
But you don't want to contradict them if they're happy or even saying it in a neutral tone. It's only if they're fearful that you want to say that. But apparently families are kind of like, oh God, they're going crazy, you know?
Yeah.
But it's a natural part of the active dying process. Breathing's going to become really weird. The patient's going to stop breathing for disconcertingly long periods of time.
Yeah. This is called Cheney-Stokes respiration. Mm-hmm. Cheney Stokes, named for John Cheney and William Stokes, obviously the first dudes who described it.
Sure.
They always get all the press. Quick, deep breaths, sometimes very slow ones, like you said, sometimes stopping altogether. And that is caused by receptors in the heart and brain stem basically being too sluggish to respond to different amounts of oxygen and CO2.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just kind of lagging behind. Again, think of it as a machine that's just slowing down, and those receptors can't pick up on it in time, so it doesn't know how to tell you to breathe, basically.
Yeah.
Like at a steady rate.
We should say that there isn't evidence that that is physically painful.
True.
Again, like,
it's awful for the healthy person in the room, yeah.
Yeah, for the family watching it, you think that the person's suffering. There's not evidence that they are, in fact, suffering.
Yeah.
But it seems like it. And that, from what I understand with palliative care, not only making the patient comfortable is one of the priorities, making the family comfortable is a priority as well, because how you die mm-hmm. has a very lasting impact on the people who are there to witness your death.
Yeah,
for
sure.
Your family.
Yeah.
So explaining that they're not suffering is helpful, but not necessarily enough.
Yeah, and I think actually this podcast itself could help like some people, because I don't think a lot of people do this sort of research when they go into a hospital room in the last hours of a loved one's life.
Yeah, and they may not be told. They may, even if it is explained to them, it might not sink in what they're being told.
Yeah.
Because, you know, seeing somebody gasping for breath and then being told that they're not really suffering, those two things might not jibe.
Well, yeah, your instinct is to probably try and get help.
Yeah.
Like, they can't breathe. Clearly, let's get a nurse in here. And the nurse is like, no, that's
part of it.
Yeah.
Another one that's very disconcerting, another sign of active dying, is the death rattle. And
yeah.
I did a don't be dumb on death rattles.
Oh, really?
And basically, either you have fluid in the lungs mm-hmm. or, like, you know, when you clear your throat like I just did?
Yeah.
That's a normal ability you have until you start dying.
Yeah.
You can't clear your throat anymore.
Yeah, those are your laryngeal muscles.
Right.
Basically spasming.
What, clearing your throat?
No, the death rattle.
No, the death rattle is just breathing through the mire.
It's both. It's either liquid or it's the muscle spasms.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay. So did you find that that's painful? Because I found that it doesn't cause pain. It's just,
No. It
sounds terrible, again, to the people in the room.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And this is, I don't think we pointed out, this is the agonal phase of death, and it's Greek for struggle and
agony.
Yeah, that sort of just encapsulates it.
I think that's probably why they call it the active phase of death now rather than agonal.
Oh, they don't even call it that anymore?
I mean, I think some people do, but I think the active and agonal are the same, one and the same.
Gotcha.
It's just, you know, they're in the agony phase.
Right.
Or they're in the active phase.
Your muscles, aside from your vocal cords, might start convulsing and spasming. You can get all, you know, herky-jerky and do things that wouldn't seem like you should be able to do in your state.
Like card tricks.
I don't know if you could do card tricks.
Shuffling card tricks from one hand to the other. And Grandpa never could before.
Yeah. I knew we'd get some humor in here somehow. What else?
Well, let's see. Your blood pressure is going to drop. Your jaw is going to drop. You might end up in a really weird, rigid position.
Yeah.
I think we said your extremities are going to be cold to the touch.
Yeah. Actually, the death rattle as a result of the spasming of your laryngeal muscles,
uh-huh.
that can also produce, what was described in what I read as a barking sound.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And I didn't search that out to see if that was recorded anywhere, but I'm curious what that sounds like.
I've heard everything from gurgling, like gurgle,
uh-huh.
to it sounds like there's marbles in your throat.
Right.
Barking, that's a new one, but I think everybody has their own signature death rattle, you know?
Yeah.
But the rule of thumb apparently among hospice workers is once the death rattle comes, it's a sign that they got about 48 hours or less left to live.
Yeah, and all of these are tells, really, and all of them. And we'll talk about what happens after the body is dead, too. And that helps with finding out, you know, in forensics, I think we pointed out plenty of times, at the time of death, depending on the various things that happen, you know, when they find you. But all of these are almost like markers on a clock.
Yeah.
And if you're in hospice care, you know these things, like, oh, this means this.
Well, they're signs and symptoms of the system shutdown that the person's body is going through, you know?
Yeah.
So, the senses apparently also are lost in a healthy person or a person who has all five senses.
Yeah.
They're lost in a certain order. and touch and hearing are the last to go.
Oh, really?
And another...
That's kind of nice.
Another very important point that hospice workers make is never, ever talk about the patient like they're not there.
Yeah, yeah.
Because they can hear you up until the end.
Yeah.
Like, hearing is kept so long as the person could hear before then and there's not any damage from, you know, during the active dying period. They can hear you until the moment they die, and you need to be careful what you say.
Yeah, and I think that's a really nice thing, that the last things that you can experience are the touch of a loved one or the voice of a loved one.
Right.
You know, you may, needs to see him.
You may not even be able to respond to that, but you can still hear.
That's true.
Yeah.
I would definitely pick that over sight. I'd rather hear someone's words as I pass rather than having silence and just seeing their faces staring at me.
So long as the words aren't... Wait, one more thing.
I think it would be almost cruel to be able to see and not hear at the end, you know?
Yeah.
Like, who wants to see your family upset? You want to hear, feel them hold your hand and say, everything's going to be all right.
So you raise a good issue. Like, there's, if you have a dying family member, especially if they're dying of frailty, or they're just dying, like they're in the dying process, or they're about to enter the dying process.
Yeah.
You could do worse things than to go online and educate yourself on how to be around them.
Yeah.
I think people don't intuitively know how to be around a dying person, and there's certain things that you should do, certain things you shouldn't do. Like, for example, they say that you should talk to the person, not the condition.
Yeah.
So don't treat them like they're frail or dying, like treat them like they're your old friend, who they are. It's extremely important to make sure that they're in a peaceful, calm environment.
Sure.
So like maybe yelling at somebody over the will is a really bad idea.
Yeah, these seem like no-brainers, but I guess some people need to be told this stuff.
Yeah, but I mean, think about it. Like, it can put you on edge being around a dying person. Like, do you mention the fact that they're going to die? Or do you know, I mean, like, do you dance around it? If they make a joke or something, like, can you laugh? Or do you laugh too hard? Do you not laugh enough? Like, I think it's not necessarily like...
Yeah.
I think it's just put you on edge.
Not everyone is as sensitive to.
So I'm going to
add one. Don't bring your laptop in there and watch reruns of The Office.
No, yeah. Are you speaking from experience?
No, I'm just going to add that.
Okay.
That's on my list.
Okay.
Get off your cell phone.
Yeah.
Pay attention to them.
Sure, yeah. I mean, that's what you're there for.
Yeah.
As hospice workers put it, you're giving them a very heartfelt gift by being there with them while they're dying.
And maybe receiving a gift, you know?
Sure.
In many religions and cultures, it's very much an honor to be a part of this whole thing. And even if you're not religious, you could just feel that way spiritually as a human.
Yeah.
You know?
Okay. Well, let's pause here because, Chuck, it's time for a message break. Stuff you should know.
Hey, everybody. It's halftime and the scoreboard is not looking good. You're feeling low and not sure you can pull out a win. And that's when you have to dig deep, lift your head up, and say to yourself, time to get back in the game. Pull off some bank heists and take as much of your friend's money as you possibly can.
That's right. The smash hit mobile game Monopoly Go lets you compete with your friends to get the most riches and the biggest empire. It's the Monopoly you love, but on your phone, anytime, with tons of new twists, including leaderboards to compare your progress to your buddies.
That's right. You can play on countless dynamic Monopoly boards. You can make your friends bankrupt by smashing their landmarks with a wrecking ball. And you can charge other players rent for your iconic properties.
Plus, you can even work with your friends to crack open community chests in tournaments to get rewards and climb the leaderboard.
So get back out there, put on your game face, and download Monopoly Go, now free on the App Store or Google Play.
Hey, everybody. If you're building a deck at work and you want to supercharge it, check out Canva presentations. Work docs have been the same for too long, but Canva docs are different. They're visual. They grab readers' attention with images, charts, tables, and videos playable right in the doc. Plus, docs don't have to be just words on a page. You can make your docs pop with Canva docs.
That's right. And Canva presentations are designed for every workplace and every department. Whether you work in sales, HR, ops, marketing, and more, Canva presentations can be the solution for you. Sales decks, marketing presentations, onboarding plans, you name it.
Canva presentations might be the most visually impressive presentations you'll ever use. Start with a stunning template, use it as a springboard for your design, adding images, graphics, charts, data visualizations, all from a massive media library. It's super easy to wow any audience with Canva presentations.
So start designing today at canva.com, designed for work. That's canva.com.
And we're back.
Okay, so are we dead yet? Are we at that point?
Yeah, the person has passed.
You just sounded very cheery.
Yeah. Well, I mean, like, we rattled off some pretty, what seems like suffering, but now the suffering is over, if there was any. The person is dead.
So once you immediately after you die, your pupils are going to dilate because the muscles controlling the iris are, you know, going to have their final rest. So your pupils are going to dilate. And then have you heard of the terminal tear or the lacrima mortis?
No.
This is a usually in the right eye, and there's no real explanation for it. But it is a final tear that you shed.
Wow.
And it doesn't always happen right after you die, although it can. They did a study in the early 90s in New Zealand, and out of 100 deaths, 14 of them right at the time of death had the lacrima mortis tear. And 13 of them in the final 10 hours. And they say to look out for that if you're the family, because it can be a sign. And also they try to talk you into the fact that it's a comforting thing,
yeah,
like, to see that tear being shed.
Wow.
Yeah. And since we're on eyes, you know the old thing where you close someone's eyes after they die?
Oh, yeah. Or you put silver dollars on.
if it's the Old West.
Yeah.
I guess people do that to... so you're not having someone, a dead body, staring at you.
Right, because if they're looking dead forward, straight yeah, forward, they're like following you all throughout the
year. Yeah, and it's definitely a movie trope. But if you don't close the eyes, and I never knew this, something called T-A-C-H-E, noir. I don't know if it's tash or tache, noir.
Okay.
That is a dark reddish-brown strip that forms horizontally over your eyeball. And I guess it's just, you know, your eyeballs dry out and has the air.
Huh.
So if you don't close the eyes, and I looked it up, you're going to see this weird horizontal stripe across your eye.
There's a, plus the effect it has on the living. The difference between seeing a dead body with their eyes closed and a dead body with their eyes open is,
yeah,
just, it's like a galaxy between the two as far as discomfort goes.
Yeah, somebody should edit together the, like, every time that's ever been done in a movie.
Yeah.
Just like super fast.
Yeah.
All right, so that's all I got on the eyes.
So, Chuck, I want to alarm you right now.
Oh, boy.
You have living in your guts right now the very organisms that are going to decompose your body when you die. They're just sitting around waiting for action.
Waiting for the signal.
Yep. When you die, there's a lot of stuff that's still alive, that's still going on, even though you're brain dead. Whole brain, higher brain, heart dead, your heart stopped.
You're dead.
That's another definition of death. I don't know if we mentioned.
Yeah.
Your heart's not beating anymore.
Right.
You're dead, yes. There's no bringing you back. You've been in, your heart hasn't, or your brain hasn't had oxygen for a while. You died of hypothermia, and they warmed you up, so now you're officially dead.
You're gone.
Right. But there's still a lot of stuff. Remember the poop shake episode?
Yeah, who can forget?
We talked about the microbiome. We have this whole other, like, part of our life, our living organism that's still around. That's still operating.
Yeah.
And a lot of stuff living within us, including part of our microbiome, they're still carrying on processes. Like, apparently, you can harvest skin cells for 24 hours.
Yeah.
And they're still alive.
Just use them.
Yeah, for all sorts of stuff.
Yeah, you can harvest them. And then, of course, inside your intestines, there's little tiny organisms that are still living and are going to help do the work that comes next.
Starting a couple days after death. Like, if you just fell over in the woods and no one was around.
I always love the setting.
Right? And you're just left there.
Uh-huh.
Within about 3 days, these organisms, the microflora, is going to go to work on you. Starting in your intestines.
Yeah, and this is after the various mortises, correct?
Yes, which I guess we should kind of go over it, but I would recommend everybody go listen to What Causes Rigor Mortis.
Yeah, for sure.
It's on the website. You can go to stuffyoushouldknow.com/podcasts slash what hyphen causes hyphen rigor hyphen mortis.
We'll just run through the mortises real quick then. Algor mortis, or the death chill.
Mm-hmm.
That's the first thing that's going to happen. That's where your body starts dropping in temperature.
Yep.
About a degree and a half Fahrenheit per hour until you are just like a nice red wine at room temperature.
Yeah.
Actually, that's not quite true.
Red wine's like 64 degrees Fahrenheit.
I guess it depends what kind of room you're in.
Yeah, if you're in a 64 degree.
It's perfect.
Yeah.
All right, what else?
Well, after algor mortis, you got rigor mortis a couple hours after death where the body settles into a stiff state.
Yeah.
And that lasts for, what, like 24 hours? I don't remember. We talked about it.
Yeah, I think so. And then between those, you have livor mortis, or sudgulation.
That's where, like, all the blood coagulates at the bottom?
Yeah, basically, your red blood cells are pretty heavy, and they just sink. And it's about 20 minutes to 3 hours after death is when you're going to be in livor mortis.
Yeah. And then after that is rigor.
That's right.
Okay.
So now back to putrefaction.
Right.
Well, that's the best thing to talk about.
Yeah, ever. That's basically like these organisms going to work, breaking down your body. And they do it pretty quick.
Yeah.
The pancreas apparently has so many in there that it just
eats itself.
It eats itself. The pancreas yeah. consumes itself.
That's pretty efficient.
Your other organs are going to eventually be consumed turned into liquid.
Yeah.
You're liquefied from the inside out.
Yeah, you're going to turn colors in this order, green, then purple, then black,
mm-hmm.
which is just like a black eye, I guess.
Yeah.
Isn't that the same stage?
Yeah, except it never fully heals.
Yeah.
It explodes. within a couple of weeks, you're going to be liquid inside.
Yeah.
The organisms that are eating you produce a gas as a byproduct from their consumption. So you're going to be bloated. Your tongue's going to stick out.
It's going to turn dark too, your tongue.
Yeah.
And that gas really stinks.
Your eyes are going to protrude.
Yeah. There's something called purge fluid. That is a putrid reddish brown fluid that can be expelled through just everywhere you've got an opening.
Right.
It can come out of your mouth, your nose, your vagina. It can be mixed with feces and come out of your rectum.
There's something else that can come out of your vagina too.
Yeah, this is maybe the worst thing I've ever heard.
I had no idea.
Yeah.
I had no idea. I know all about death and all that, and it's like interests me. I had never heard of this before.
I don't even want to talk about it. You don't either. Maybe we should type it into the computer and make the computer say it.
Do we have that ability?
Coffin birth.
Oh, wow. That was pretty good, Chuck. That was a good computer impression. So wait, that's what you do when you don't want to say something yourself? You pretend you're a computer?
Yeah, Emily and I, most of our fights are like that.
Really?
Yeah.
That's pretty cute.
I go into a war games mode.
What was it again, computer?
Coffin birth.
Coffin birth. So basically, those gases that, this is a real thing. We're not making this up.
Yeah, post-mortal fetal extrusion is another name for it.
So the gases that build up in the body before the body ruptures, which comes a little later, can become so pressurized that a pregnant woman who has died
mm-hmm.
with the fetus still in utero
yeah.
can actually, the gases can push the fetus out of the vagina,
yeah.
Which is coffin birth.
Yeah, and this doesn't happen much anymore.
No.
Thankfully, because we take care of dead bodies pretty quickly. Although they did find evidence of it in a case in 2008 where this woman was found like in the woods. But it was described a lot in like 16th to 18th century medical literature.
Oh, you know, it just drove them crazy too.
Oh, sure.
Like, she was obviously alive for weeks afterward.
Yeah. And archaeologists apparently too are have to rethink sometimes when they find, because sometimes you would die during childbirth, but they would bury the baby with the mother.
Right.
And so you would find the bones like cradling each other almost.
Mm-hmm.
But then they go back, they've had to go back and look at some where they find the, you know, between the legs, the bones of the baby, and they think that might be the case, like of a coffin birth.
Right.
Boy.
So there's the worst thing in the world.
Yeah.
There's
probably a death metal band with that name.
If there's not, there is now.
Yeah.
So the gas is ultimately, eventually, once they start, once they really get down to business and they're no longer just, what's it called where the fluid's coming out of little orifices here or there?
Purge fluid.
Okay, so once it's like, enough with the purge fluid,
yeah,
we're just going to tear the sucker open. Your body ultimately ruptures.
Yeah, and this is, you know, your skin is already blistered at this point. Mm-hmm. Your hair, nails, and teeth have fallen out. They don't keep growing.
No, it's your skin receding from drying out, from desiccating.
Yeah, so pass that around in school, kids. Mm-hmm. When someone says that your fingernails keep growing after death, you set them straight. Tell them Josh sent you.
Oh, God, I just realized there's kids listening to this.
Yeah. And then the old degloving, which we've talked about before.
Oh, yeah, I forgot about that.
Remember that?
Yeah, where the that can happen to you if you drive at 10 and 2. And you have an airbag, the gases that expand the airbag out of your steering wheel are very hot. And if you're not driving at 9 and 3 and you have your hands at like 10 and 2 or something,
yeah,
like you're going to be degloved.
Really?
Alive. Yeah.
But, yeah.
Your skin is just burned right off your hands, or it's burned and separated and then eventually comes off.
So 10 and 2 is not how you should drive any longer?
Not anymore, no.
Really?
That's what I've learned.
Yeah, I drive it either just a straight up 6 o'clock with one hand.
Yeah.
Or a nooner, just a straight up noon.
Noon.
I rarely have two hands on the wheel.
You don't drive with like your knees with your hands behind your head, relaxing?
Occasionally if I'm, you know.
Relaxing?
Yeah, or playing the guitar or something.
Okay, so degloving.
Yeah, degloving is, I know we talked about this in probably rigor mortis, but that's when you're.
Or body farms maybe.
Yeah. That's when basically your skin is removed. Still attached to things like fingernails and things like that. And they call it degloving for a reason I don't think we need to explain.
No, it makes perfect sense.
Or desocking. Sometimes, it can happen to your feet.
Well, I hadn't heard of that one. Did you just make that up?
Well, they said gloves or socks if it's your feet. Huh. But I did make up desocking.
Desocking.
Well, I'm going to have to use that from now on.
Yeah, that's good.
That might be a new thing.
So the body. Once it ruptures, your organs are already liquid, and all that's left is a skeleton, which will eventually turn to dust too.
Can we be done? No, wait, we can't be done because we do need to talk a little bit about assisted suicide.
Yeah,
I just teed that up for you.
Boy, you sure did. That's quite a controversial subject. Like we said, I don't know if I said or not. Like this has just been such a huge whirlwind of input.
Yeah.
Of information in my head in the last like 36 hours studying for this.
Sure.
That I don't know what I've said yet or not, or what we talked about in another podcast. But
yeah.
So we talked about dying of frailty, of old age, and that it's increasing.
Yeah.
Supposedly, 5 out of 10 people in the United States will die in the intensive care unit. And I saw this TED talk from Newcastle, Australia,
mm-hmm.
with this guy. I can't remember what his name is, but it's about dying. I think it's called Can We Talk About Dying or something.
Right.
And his point was, you're going to die in the ICU, whether you want to or not,
right.
if you die of a degenerative disease or frailty, unless you say you don't want to die there. Because
right.
the way medical science is currently set up, you are going to be treated most of the time up until the bitter end with life-saving measures.
Sure.
And you're going to die in the ICU with tubes hooked up and things beeping and, like, other people having crash carts taken in and out of their room and
yeah.
people making a big ruckus up until the point you die, unless they give you palliative care or you say, I don't want to be sustained like that. I don't want to go to the ICU. And his point was, if half of Americans are going to die in the ICU.
Uh-huh.
You have to assume that maybe not all of them would want to die in the ICU.
Right.
And therefore they need to think of things like, I want an advance directive, a living will.
Mm-hmm.
I want a living power of attorney to somebody to say, no, do not put them on a ventilator.
Yeah.
Do not put them in feeding tubes. Like, they don't want that. They
yeah.
just want to die, or they want to go to hospice. They want to go back home.
Right.
That's another big one. Like, they don't let you go back home.
Right.
Especially if you can't speak for yourself. Like, to medical science these days, that's crazy. You don't leave the hospital when you know you're dying. You stay in the hospital and we keep doing stuff until you die.
Right.
That's not the way it jives with a lot of people, but if you don't stop and think about it and then write it down or tell somebody who can speak for you, That's, you're not going to go home.
Yeah,
you're
you
not
need
going to,
do to that.
Go to hospice. You have to do this ahead of time. And part of that that's kind of come out of this idea is, okay, well, if we have autonomy to say, I don't want you to intubate me.
Yeah.
Why don't we have the autonomy to say, I want you to give me some stuff that's going to painlessly end my life? Because
yeah.
it's either that or facing a tremendous amount of pain and suffering.
Right.
Through this degenerative disease.
Yeah, basically saying, I'm ready. I am ready. It is my life. It's like the Richard Dreyfuss movie from the 80s. That covered us. Whose life is it anyway, I think?
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Yeah, I think so. It was a movie.
Okay.
About assisted suicide. And do you, should you have the right to be able to, you know, it's a hot button issue for sure. But apparently most Americans, or the majority of Americans, actually support it until you start using a word like suicide.
Right. When you poll them and say, do you, are you in favor of doctors helping someone to painlessly end their life or something
yeah.
at the end of life?
They'd say, sure.
Yeah. And then they're like, okay, so you're in favor of physician-assisted suicide?
No.
Right.
yeah. Well, what's that word, you know?
And the doctors who are in favor of euthanasia is another term for it. Look at palliative care. It's like half of a step away from physician-assisted suicide.
Yeah.
Like you're keeping somebody, if they request it, knocked down on morphine for the rest of their life. So they're never going to regain consciousness.
Yeah.
There's this, you dug up this one article by a British physician who argues that, that agonal, gasping
yeah.
reflex, apparently when part of the apnea is that your body has a reflex where you gasp for air,
mm-hmm.
and it's really disconcerting to family members, even though they don't think that you're suffering.
Yeah.
It looks like you're suffering. And this doctor argued, well, we have drugs that can block this response so that the person can't gasp for air.
Right.
And what, it's going to cost them their last couple of breaths. But these last couple of breaths make it appear like they're suffering and the family remembers that their kids suffered.
Yeah.
So why wouldn't we do that? And there's this conversation that's taking place more and more and more that ultimately it's kind of like, who is somebody to say that somebody can't choose to end their own life
yeah.
painlessly through the use of like drugs?
Yeah. Or like Hunter Thompson did.
Well, I mean, that's another way to go. And you, anybody can do that.
Sure.
But there are some people out there who don't want to die violently. They
yeah,
want
to
die peacefully.
Or to leave that for their family. Like, that's the part that I was upset about with that, was his wife, like, finding him and stuff.
Yeah, his wife and his son.
Yeah. That's
and it was like, not only that, he did it in his own basement, which yeah, I can understand doing it at home, but he left quite a mess in his own basement for his family to clean up.
But if he had other options these days, like doctor-assisted suicide, he might not have had to make a mess in his basement for his family.
Yeah. And Chuck, we know that Hunter Thompson is far from the only person to make his own exit his own way.
Sure.
Another very famous person, Sigmund Freud did too, huh?
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, you know that.
Assisted suicide.
Yeah, literally physician-assisted suicide. He was diagnosed with cancer of the palate
uh-huh.
because he smoked tons of cigars.
Right.
Which were sometimes just a cigar.
I was about to say.
And for 16 years, he lived with that diagnosis. And finally, toward the end, he asked his surgeon, his physician, go ahead and hit me up with, I think, 5 grams of morphine. Like,
wow.
Just a ton of morphine. And he died 3 hours after the injection of it. But
which was more than his usual 2 grams of morphine.
Right. Yeah. Or cocaine. He loved cocaine.
Yeah.
But he had developed what was called Todenangst.
That's German.
Which is a dread of death.
Yeah.
So, and so he lived with that for 16 years, but he finally, he decided along the way, like, I fear this, but I'm going to take it into my own hands.
Huh.
Physician-assisted suicide, 1939. Yeah. And there's definitely more than one side to this coin.
Like, oh, yeah.
There's a lot of people, there's very strong opinions on either side, but
sure.
I think it's at the very least, even if you remove emotion from it, it's an extremely interesting conversation. In that it reveals so much about our attitudes toward death.
Totally.
And autonomy. And like who has the right to decide whether they're going to die or who has the right to tell somebody that they can't do that.
Whose life is it anyway?
Yeah.
Richard Dreyfuss.
And then Chuck, one other thing that we want to hit on is, regret.
Yeah. I actually saw this a few weeks ago just by chance and then you sent it to me. I think it was in England, a hospice nurse. Spent a lot of time researching life regrets over the course of a certain amount of time. and came up with the five most common life regrets. And I think this is like a good way to end it, you know? Number one, I wish I had the courage to live a life true to myself and not the life others expected of me.
Right.
That was the number one regret.
Yeah.
Number two was, I wish I didn't work so hard. That didn't surprise me at all.
Yeah.
Number three, I wish I had the courage to express my feelings. Number four, I wish I'd stayed in touch with my friends. That's a very sad one. And I wish I'd let myself be happier is number five.
Yeah, like she was saying that they didn't realize till the end of their life that happiness is a choice.
Right.
That you make. It's not something that happens to you. It's something you go search out. It's a state of mind that you strive for.
Sure.
And to figure that out, like, at the end, that's a regret.
Yeah. So, call to action, people.
Yeah, really. Like, these.
Think about this stuff.
You don't have to wish these things on your deathbed if you start doing something about it now.
Exactly.
Dying, Chuck. You know what we might have just done? We might have just witnessed the death of the death suite.
I bet there's something else.
Yeah, only time can tell, but I don't know how much more aspects of death we can cover. And I'll tell you what, I'm going to put all of them together in a blog post.
Oh, nice.
The death suite. So everybody can go listen to all things death via Stuff You Should Know.
What a gift.
Yeah. In the meantime, if you want to look up more about dying, just type dying into the search bar at How Stuff Works. I think it has its own channel. There's so much to it. And since I said search bar, it's time for listener mail.
This is a nice one. We don't normally do shout outs, but this was a nice one, and I thought, what better way to end such a depressing show? Hey guys, and Jerry, love the podcast. Josh, I have to thank you for teaching my fiance Danny and me about the flashlight trick to see spider eyes at night.
Oh yeah.
I still haven't done it, man. I never think about it at night.
Jerry, you said you tried it, right? And it worked? Yeah.
Okay, well, I need to do it. I need to set a reminder.
And my response to people who've been like, can you explain it again? Practice. That's my explanation. Just practice. Just try it from a different angle.
Okay.
Just practice. It's a real thing. It's not a trick.
It is completely amazing. And this is from Peachy, by the way. And it's wonderful and frightening at the same time. But the problem now is that whenever we walk our dogs at night, I just can't have my normal fiance. I have this dude with a flashlight stuck to his forehead, stopping at every field to let me know just how many spiders our dogs are stepping on and how we are always surrounded. Thanks for the show. And now, for a shameless request. I know you don't often give shout-outs, but it would be the most amazing thing ever if you could give a shout-out to Danny on the podcast that airs sometime before our wedding on October 13th.
Oh, nice.
Let him know that I love him more than anything and that I'm excited to share my life with him, even if he does have a flashlight stuck to his forehead for the rest of our lives walking our dogs together. I know this would totally blow him away, and I would even let him listen to that podcast first. So thanks to Jerry. Thanks, guys. That is from Peachy.
Way to go, Peachy.
In Thousand Oaks, California.
I think Peachy just expressed it very nicely.
Yeah. So, Danny, Peachy, congratulations.
Yeah. Best of luck. Best wishes from us.
I told her, listen up for it on the Dying podcast, and she thought that was kind of funny, and it's like, great.
Yeah, and Danny, maybe put down a flashlight once in a while.
Yeah, pay attention to your wife. And Peachy, don't use the word fiancé so much.
Okay. That's a life lesson from Chuck right there.
No one likes to hear that.
If you want to see if you can talk Chuck into a shout out, take your best shot. You can tweet to us at SYSK Podcast. You can talk to him directly on Facebook.com/StuffYouShouldKnow. That's where he spends all of his time. You can send us an email to stuffpodcast@discovery.com. And you can join us at our website, our very own website. It's called StuffYouShouldKnow.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com.
Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there with 18,000 agents across the country who are ready to help you 24/7, 365. That's getting to a better state.
The first cell phone was demonstrated in 1973 by Martin Cooper. But you know what wasn't demonstrated? Shared plans. Over 50 years later, you can save on one line, thanks to Visible. It's true. So switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon for just $25 a month, taxes and fees included. Switch now at Visible.com.
Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit visible.com.
In Puerto Rico, there's adventure around every corner and natural treasures waiting to be explored, like El Yunque, the only tropical rainforest in the U.S. Get swept away by natural beauty and come away with unique stories that could only be experienced in Puerto Rico and that remind you why you travel in the first place. Visits end, but stories last forever. You don't become a part of the island, it becomes a part of you. No passports required for U.S. citizens and permanent residents. Learn more and plan your trip at discoverpuertorico.com.